Hello and welcome back, everyone. Ecosystemic Futures is the Shoshenworks Foresight Series with NASA Heritage. Today, we're going to talk about what happens when you combine two decades of Silicon Valley innovation with a passion for democratizing education, and then point all of that experience at one of science's most provocative frontiers. This is going to be fun. Today, we're experiencing and exploring how technology leadership, workforce transformation, and unconventional research converge to inspire the next generation of scientists and innovators. I'm Diane Finkhausen, CEO of Shoshenworks, and I'm joined today by David Julian, former head of industry for education technology at Google, where he built a global team partnering with universities, ed tech companies, and workforce organizations serving millions of learners worldwide. David now serves on the steering committee for Harvard's Galileo Project, an AI-powered astrophysics initiative, and advises organizations on AI adoption, data strategy, and the future of workforce skills. With experience spanning startups, Yahoo, Facebook, and Google, David brings a unique perspective on how technology ecosystems can transform education and inspire scientific curiosity. So, David, what an amazing journey you've been on. I just am blown away by the strategic arc of your career, and I'm really fascinated by the work that you're leading right now. Introduce your journey and your current areas of focus.
Sure. Well, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you again for having me, Diane. And I'm very much looking forward to virtually speaking with your audience through this. So, about David, I guess. Boy, where could I start? I grew up in upstate New York, Syracuse, New York. Both my parents were educators. My mother was a history teacher for 30 years in the Syracuse school district. And my father was a professor for 30, 40, 50 years at Syracuse University. And so I grew up in a very academic-oriented household. Though I was a good student, I wasn't a great student. And I think as I've gotten older in my life and career, my appreciation for academics and academia has really greatly accelerated versus David Julian as a 16-year-old as well. It's kind of like that progressive ad of becoming your parents. I think that I've really felt that in many ways. But I grew up in academic environments, and I was around, my parents were always going to like continuing, you know, education courses, ongoing development, professional development, things like that. And so that was just the environment I grew up in conversations about current events and global politics and things like that is what we talked about at the dinner table. And one thing that was really formulative for me as a kid, right at the end of the Cold War, my father was a political science professor at Syracuse. And right at the end of the Cold War, so this is the fall of 1990, spring of 91, my father was invited to teach in Budapest, Hungary for a semester. And that turned into about a 10, 12 year journey for him, where he was living in Budapest and helping the schools and universities across East and Central Europe revitalize their curriculum around kind of a Western democratic, I guess, nature, for lack of a better phrase. And I was a teenage kid, and my father had this cool apartment in Budapest at the end of the Cold War. And it was such a neat experience. It was so neat. And it really just taught me, you know, just the power of how like education really unites and inspires folks. And my job many times, we would send these professors back from Russia and things like that back to Syracuse. And my job was to like take them to basketball games and stuff. And it was just so neat to see how much, you know, one, appreciation for democracy and civics, and two, just how, you know, really just taught you how, you know, how there's a lot more in common that we have with people from different countries and cultures than we really appreciate, and how much education really brings that together in folks. And it was just such a wonderful experience as a kind of a teenager or someone in my early 20s to kind of see that firsthand at that time. You know, I think our generation, you appreciate how scary the Cold War was. And all of a sudden, this kind of scary thing we had over our heads for decades, generations almost, was lifted. And all of a sudden, you pull back the curtain and like, you know, how similar we were to, you know, folks that we had nuclear missiles aimed at for decades was shocking. anyway, so that was really impactful for me growing up. And then I graduated college, an undergrad from Syracuse in 1995, and started off my career in Manhattan trying to figure kind of the world out. And all of a sudden, this thing called the internet started to come up. I remember I was working for an advertising agency, and we had this all-hands meeting, and they were like, we're going to have this thing that we're going to roll out called email, so you don't need to fax stuff or inter-office mail things anymore to your clients and all that type of stuff. I can't believe I caught the tail end of a world where we didn't have email. Anyway, the internet came about in the late 90s, and I was ready for a change for Manhattan. I missed trees and things like that growing up in Syracuse. So I moved to San Francisco with a teeny tiny little startup that I really didn't really understand what they did, but they would pay me a small salary and I could have medical benefits. And that sounded good to me. And San Francisco seemed like a cool place to live. And so I moved out here with this teeny little startup. And 30 years later or so, I'm still in San Francisco. And the startup was a company called hotjobs.com. So if you're an internet 1.0 person, you might remember that brand. But it was a wonderful experience for me because I really saw our office was in Burlingame, California, above a tanning salon in kind of a loft in a strip mall with no air conditioning. So it'd get really hot. You know, San Francisco is cold, but you get out towards the airport, SFO, man, it gets hot. And so we had no air conditioning. We had fans, and it was the startup dream. And I would wake up on Saturday mornings and I was bummed that I didn't have work that day. And it just really kind of gave me the itch and the fun and the stimulation of being a part of an entrepreneurial startup. And I also really appreciated the workforce development aspect of it, that to think that I was actually doing something that, hey, might help somebody, you know, find a new job. And so that what really I found the inspiration of kind of help being able to combine a business that also helped people find jobs, help companies more efficiently hire people at scale. It was really powerful. It was kind of one of the first, it was an internet brand, B2C brand, but it was also one of the very early SaaS companies as well. And Hot Jobs, you know, kind of lived the Silicon Valley dream. It went public. .com crash happens. We ended up getting bought by Yahoo. And that what kind of got me into kind of big tech out in Silicon Valley. So I went from Yahoo to, was at Yahoo for a long time. And then a couple other startups, spent time at Facebook, and then spent about the last 8 or so years of my career at Google. And kind of throughout that time, I went back to school. So again, where you mimic your parents, all of a sudden, the person who was a good student, but not a great student, realized how wonderful education can be. And I was a new dad with a young infant and married. And I went back to school and got my MBA at night in my 40s. And that was really helpful to kind of take my career to the next stage. And that really just gave me appreciation, kind of continuously learning. So yeah. So anyway, my last role at Google was I managed a really important partnership with LinkedIn. And then after doing that, I moved into a role where I led, just right before COVID happened, helping Google launch their education technology side of the business. And that was I found that equally inspiring to my kind of early entrepreneurial days with hotjobs.com, helping people find jobs. That started a little bit earlier. Now you're helping give people the skills to be successful in life from
careers,
pre-K to gray, as we would call it.
I love that. That's great. Well, and I'd love to get to what you're doing today with Harvard too, but if we could maybe just double click into that. So you moved to San Francisco in, was it 1998?
1998. Yep.
And literally rode the consumer internet wave through startup Yahoo. Yep. You mentioned Facebook and Google. It's basically a front row seat to basically multiple technology revolutions.
Yeah.
What kind of strategic patterns did you observe about which innovations actually transform industries and society?
Yeah.
Those that just become footnotes. And
yeah,
the whole or both, right?
So yeah. Yep.
How did that inform your pivot towards education? You touched on that a little bit, but.
Yeah. Easier said than done, I think, in many ways. But I think what I observed, because I, you know, the business is cyclical, right? And, you know, you see what is the strong players. Oftentimes, you know, being first doesn't mean you're going to win area. There was And there's, you know, when a new technology comes around, or like kind of a paradigm shifting technology, like the internet was, like AI was, boy, it sure feels a lot like 1999 in San Francisco right now. All right. Yeah. What I would say, what I learned is, everyone's going to say like, hey, is there a market for this, right? Are you solving a critical like need? And that certainly is important. But I think, you know, one thing I've learned is that, hey, is this a technology that is fundamentally like changing a person's life for the better? And is it easy to use? You know, think about, you know, all the devices out there. Why was Apple successful over the hundreds, thousands of other device companies? Is it easy to use? And is it kind of teaching your users, is it teaching your kind of community, I guess, something new and how to do something? So if you think about how search really taught users, and it could be anybody from a very technical, like adept person to somebody who had never really experienced technology before, how simple that was to now find and access data and information. Very simple and clean, right? Rewind to maybe when you and I were kids and you had to do, say, a research paper, and you like, remember the Dewey Decimal System? I just remember how hard it was just even to figure out how to use the card catalog in the library. Like that in itself was almost a class you had to take just to do your research, right? And yeah. So, you know, early search really taught us this kind of like how you can easily find and organize information. And I think you look at when smartphones came out, 2007, it really taught us kind of harness the kind of like compute technology in our back pockets, basically, you know? And so how you could almost in essence live your life instead of having this like this huge operating systems, all these different like things going on in your life, your phone could really just become your day-to-day operating system, from music, communication, transportation, staying in touch, et cetera, et cetera. And so those were some of the things that really step out. And then you look at kind of social media, and Facebook, I think, really taught people how they can quickly join and build communities at scale, you know? And, it, you know, if I wanted to go make new friends, it's not always the easiest thing to do, or connect with people, or find like-minded folks that are interested in this band or this, you know, sports team, or et cetera, et cetera. In an analog world, that might be tough to find a large group to do that with. You know, social media changed that. Now, all those kind of broad technologies that I mentioned, there are also like downfalls with those as well. They're not all perfect. And, you know, there are great benefits that they've all brought to society, but there are some downsides that come with that. But, you know, that's kind of, I think any technology that you've seen over the years, there are good and bad things that come along with that.
No doubt. With the level of actually increasing level of interconnectedness, right, in the digital era, how important a role does the ecosystem play, right? As you're introducing new technologies, new models, how important is it to get a strong ecosystem play where you get that tipping point within the network of networks, if you will?
Yeah, right. I mean, obviously incredibly important. And you think about, you know, Apple's App Store, Google Play, and those ecosystems, and just what they did to amplify mobile usage and device uses and make ubiquitous in many ways. So incredibly important. You think of, I try to like put it into kind of real world, when, you know, maybe when you and I were kids, you went to the mall, right? You go to the mall because there's lots of stores. There's lots of things you can eat, you can play some video games, maybe go to the movies, get a new pair of shoes, get a poster for your room, et cetera, et cetera. That ecosystem changes in the digital world, right? Now you can go to places where an app store, for lack of a better phrase, will like becomes your mall in many ways. So those things are obviously incredibly important. You think about marketplaces, you think about early internet, you know, think about eBay and Amazon and what they turned into. And I think eBay was like a place to trade. I think the founder was place originally where you traded your Beanie Babies. You know, Beanie Babies were like this hot fad of the 90s, but you need like
Cabbage Patch Kids.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so like kind of the importance of marketplaces. So yeah, so incredibly, incredibly important, and not always easy to do.
Yeah. No, the ecosystem, I think, is just really challenging shift for a lot of innovators, right? A lot of technologists to understand the and make sense of and navigate effectively within a network of networks, right? A very dynamic, fluid marketplace environment where new competitors are emerging daily, new technologies, new capabilities. It's a constant balance between sensing, sense making, and seizing, right?
Yeah.
Environment. And it's basically a new skill, right? For as we talk about the education process and lifelong learning, young professionals need to have that constant market awareness
yes.
in order to navigate well in businesses, right? To maintain resilience in what can be a very challenging market environment.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And the pace and timing is so much faster.
Yeah.
I mean, now than just like 2 years ago and 5 years ago and certainly 20 years ago and 50 years ago. I mean, it is, you know, AI's been around for many, many years, decades.
Right.
But this, you know, and we've been using it for decades, for lack of a better phrase. But now, you know, what it's doing to change businesses and, you know, really understanding now how much is at your actual fingertips and how you're controlling AI in many ways versus using AI to find the best route to commute into work is much different. And so, yeah, so the pace of change is just dramatic that I don't really think the Googles and the open AIs of the world really even understand it yet.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I'm not sure that anybody does, right? To your earlier point, you rightly raised the point that in all of these technologies and capabilities that are flowing through markets and society today, you have both harmful and beneficial.
Potential. Yeah. Yeah.
When we were working with NASA on the futures work, we spent a lot of time on that, right? You have the harmful and the beneficial branches, right? To the scenarios. And how do you detect and discern early those triggers for harmful pathways, prune those and re-navigate to the more beneficial potential as the innovation is flowing through the markets and bring the adopters along with you, bring the regulators along with you.
Yeah.
It's a challenge, right?
It is a challenge.
Today's innovators, today's professionals face. And I love the convergence that you have really built into your journey, your portfolio, that education focus. And that eventually led to a really exciting new chapter at Google. You built something very significant, very special at Google. So building that ed tech ecosystem at Google, walk us through kind of what you built there. For 6 years, you led that education technology partnership ecosystem at Google, working with amazing organizations like Coursera, Grammarly, and UCLA, and many more.
Yep.
You weren't just selling ads. You were actually helping these organizations digitize content, reach more learners, drive new experiences, and drive outcomes. So what does that, in your perspective, what does that actually mean to drive kind of ed tech ecosystem at scale?
Yeah.
Experience. And what can you share with others that are trying to do similar?
Yeah. Outcomes? Yeah. I kind of go back. I'm like, if you told David Julian this was the type of things that I would be, you know, 1988, this is what you'd be doing, I would have been like, what? I didn't really even know how to turn on a computer in 1988. Anyway, yeah. So I learned a lot. And I will always be indebted to many ways to Google, just how much I learned there. And just Google, I really learned a lot about just like scale and technology and how quickly, you know, the importance of scale and the need for optimal technology to scale things, right? And, you know, Google gave me a great appreciation for the importance of research and development and building out your technology, the importance of having like strong feedback loops to understand, you know, why or why not something is or is not working, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, the importance of, you know, having a respect and an understanding of the global nature of things and how different countries, different regions, et cetera, both from regulatory world, as well as just like kind of user consumer behavioral, you know, cultural norms, things like that, how important that is to take in, and, you know, how much you can just learn from, you know, user interest and data, and how much is out there for companies and organizations, as well as, you know, like us as individuals that you have access to learn. One thing I really appreciate about Google is, and this is public, a lot of this is public info that anybody can see, but, you know, the understanding of like what people are searching on and how you can extrapolate that into what's happening in real time. You know, I mean, I think, gosh, is it the World Bank? One of the major like financial economic research organizations, they use Google data, like search behavior, to kind of get a sense of what's going on in real time with GDP and things like that. So anyway, so that's, I guess, a long-winded way to kind of give a high-end answer to some of that. But I think just, you know, what I think about a lot, what I learned is helping, you know, if I'm an organization and I want to, let's use education, I would stay on the education theme of helping learners improve their lives. The key importance there is, you know, am I providing something that is going to give you value and that you will be able to do and complete? You know, it doesn't do a university any good, or, you know, a utility tool online that you can buy, or a class that you can buy online, if you're not going to use it, one, and two, if you're not going to complete it. And so it's really important. It's kind of the sense of outcomes. Like, are you driving, you know, I have so many subscriptions that I buy that I don't end up using, you know, like, and we all do, right? So if you think about, you don't want your education in many ways to become like one of those subscriptions that you just kind of pay for every month, but you don't end up really getting value out of. And so understanding how you're helping organizations build things and have the tools and the policies and the technologies in place to drive the optimal outcome, you know, that is really important. And I think now with you know, I'll keep just the educational sphere, with everything that we have now with AI, from a virtual tutor to also understanding kind of, you know, red flags early on, if somebody, you know, student A is going to be struggling in this, how we identify that early and correct that is so powerful. Anyway, Google, I think, I mean, lots of technologies are out to do that. I learned that was really helpful in my career to kind of experience that firsthand and see it with Google, and seeing how learning about how companies can, or organizations, learning organizations can take their offerings and digitize them and bring them out at scale. And there's nuances throughout the world. And if I'm going to build an app, you know, if I'm building a new learning app and my market is the United States, we have awesome broadband here in the US, right? We have awesome Wi-Fi systems, right? Many parts of the world don't yet still. And so, you know, so if I'm building, say, an app for APAC, I want to, or, you know, some countries in Asia Pacific or in Africa and things like that, where you might have less strong, like kind of broadband and Wi-Fi, you want to build a light app, you know? So you want to be building technologies that are, make it easy for the user to use and engage with. It's all those types of things.
Yeah. No, we just had a recording session with some incredible guests yesterday in Africa, and it was a noticeable difference, right, in the recording uploads.
Yeah.
Or is it just in the app?
Yeah.
The quality of the feed. So yeah, it's real, right? You experience
it
firsthand. But AI has become absolutely transformational. And I think we're, you know, as you mentioned, it's been around for decades. It's now becoming more mainstream, more embedded, and transformational, right? And I think we're only beginning to understand the real potential, the real risk, and the real potential. But it's now transforming everything, really, about how we learn and work. So if we dive into that frontier a little bit, to your point, So you've observed really how AI democratizes access to skill and learning.
Yeah.
Really in ways that we have never seen before. And so if people are actually now listing ChatGPT on their resumes instead of college degrees.
Yeah.
OpenAI is moving into certifications and the job space.
Yep.
Nod back to hot jobs, right? So what does this mean for the traditional education ecosystem? Is this disruption or destruction?
It's definitely disruption, but I think in many ways it points to both the opportunity and the importance still of traditional education and higher education. And where I do think, you know, there's so many wonderful certifications that you can take. And I mentioned the kind of the anecdote there, folks putting like kind of OpenAI, ChatGPT education on their resumes. It is wonderful how much skills have been democratized now with all these things that, you know, instead of having to spend thousands of dollars, let's say, to learn a type of computer programming language or something like that, you can just do that online now via the OpenAIs of the world or YouTube or something like that for free or for very affordable. The challenge many times is as employers, there is a validation of seeing XY University in many ways on a resume, just that it kind of gives this third party, you know, the sense of accreditation, I think, is still really powerful in employers, in many employers' eyes. Not for every job, though. There's kids now who are, I think it's incredible, who are like foregoing college because they're getting offers right out of high school to come work at major technology companies. It's fascinating. It's incredible. So I do think there's a balance there of the skills that are now and the technologies now that are democratized, that you have easy access to, that there's not some exclusive organization that you had to apply to and, you know, spend a lot of money to go to get these skills. But there is a balance, I think, of, hey, till we find a way to, I guess, quantify or validate at scale skills that I'm learning through AI, a university, you know, XYZ accredited university, I still think subliminally for hiring managers and recruiters at most companies, that still carries a lot of weight. What I do think is really cool, though, is that how much access that learners now, and learners, again, pre-K to grad, have access to accelerate their learning, their value, and their employment opportunities. And I would say, you know, so many companies now have certifications that I can get certified. You know, it was almost like in the vocational, you know, you were like going to vocational learning, you had to get, you know, HVAC certified or something like that. You know, there are so many, and they're often free, that you can take to get certified. You know, Anthropic has Anthropic Academy, OpenAI, they all, you know, Google has their certificate. I spent a lot of time working with kind of on the certifications that Google and its partners were rolling out. And, you know, these are free, very affordable things. So when you can kind of stack on, let's say, classic education, and then layer on, you know, these certifications, that is really, really powerful, you know, regardless of what you're majoring in. You know, that's what I think is really neat. Like, I think liberal arts degrees kind of get questioned a lot, which rightfully so in many ways, in terms of like, hey, are these skills? Critical thinking is so incredibly important, like now probably more than ever. And I truly believe you get that with a liberal arts kind of education, but there also it's important to have like tangible, like real-time skills that you can walk into many employers with right now. And being able to layer on a certification on top of these, like maybe traditional, for many folks, traditional kind of academic pursuits is really, really powerful. Google had done a lot of research just around folks with, let's say, like a psychological degree, like some type of, you know, like a psychology degree, but who also had like a data analytics certificate, just what the median income was for those folks versus who didn't have those kind of two things together. So anyway, I think these things are really exciting and they offer a ton of like real-time opportunities, both for educators and learners, and I guess platforms, the open AIs of the world. I think universities have a huge, 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 huge opportunity right now. I think their business models are many times broken and challenged, but I think there's a huge opportunities. I think they play an important role in society. I think they've got a kind of a tough brand issue and many PR issues in many ways, but I think there's a huge opportunity for them. And I think there's a huge importance they have in our society and culture as well.
I think a lot of them are starting to experiment.
Yeah.
With different models as well, which is pretty cool to watch. Actually, would love to pull the thread a little bit more. So the speed at which AI can now process information is, in your words, mind-boggling and accelerating. Yeah. So I also fascinating. Last year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry went to researchers who weren't even chemists.
Yeah.
So what does this convergence in your mind mean for how we think about expertise, specialization, and interdisciplinary collaboration, to your point?
Yeah, it's kind of similar to what I was just saying, you know, these things just, you stack them, stack these things onto each other. And, you know, just the acceleration is, there really is paradigm shifting, you know, that what might've been a very kind of hands-on, difficult computational analysis that you had to do that could take days and days, hours and hours, can be done so quickly. If now that you have access to this data, it's mind-boggling. And I think, you know, when I think about all these things, I think what's important is understanding how to use all, I guess for lack of a word, it's like understanding how to all use this. Like there's, you can't just rely on, you know, you can't just rely on one aspect. You have to rely on both. I guess I'm going to like kind of think like traditional job education, like skills versus new AI world skills. Both are important. You know, you can't just rely on AI to do my job for me, or I can't just rely on AI to be the answer for everything. Just like I can't just rely on the old ways of how I went about working in America, being a student in America, being a learner in America, being an employer in America. That is absolutely, those two things have to get married and understanding how to do them correctly. So the Nobel Prize chemistry, that's a great example. You know, I see it with a lot of the awesome work that the scientists at Harvard are doing with Galileo. You know, here you can be an expert in astronomy or physics, but now having this kind of technical expertise on how you are training AI models, I mean, those are a little different, those skill sets, right? But yeah. How that accelerates and compounds things is astounding, you know? So that's what I kind of think about when I think about like marrying those things. You know, if I'm a brilliant researcher now and I have some type of research, you know, you name the type of research, but now I have a technical expertise and how to use AI to apply to my research. That is really, really powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. And then augmenting that with the right ecosystem and ecosystem mindset. I love that you've brought us to your work at Harvard's Galileo Project. That's really a fascinating application of these themes. I had just a little bit of a touch point with the Galileo Project in a recent congressional hearing that I attended, but I'd love to kind of dig into that. So you serve on the steering committee of Harvard's Galileo Project, and I'd love to have you kind of walk our listeners through what that is, right? Based on kind of our conversations, Galileo Project uses AI for astrophysics research, including the study of UAPs. And you have mentioned that if your high school physics class had UAP research as a hook, you'd have paid more attention. And I'm in that corner as well. So what drew you to the project and what do you see is kind of fundamentally inspiring about scientific curiosity and kind of the work that's being done in that portfolio.
Yeah. Galileo, Harvard's Galileo Project really to me, it just symbolizes all the wonderful things that can happen with technology, academia, academics, lifelong learning, inspiration, you know, curiosity. It really symbolizes those things. And so that folks who may or may not know, listening to the podcast, the Galileo Project is a research initiative out of Harvard's astrophysics department led by Professor Avi Loeb that is studying this concept of UAPs, so unidentified anomalous phenomenon. These things used to be called UFOs, now they're called UAPs. And also just looking at kind of all these fascinating things happening with these interstellar objects that now we have now observed three different times that come into our solar system. So interstellar, you know, being outside in some type of object coming outside of our solar system into our solar system. And I got involved with this project. I was in, you know, I like sci-fi movies as a kid. I never really gave much thought into the whole topic of UFOs and things like that. But I do, when some of these things coming out of the government, 60 Minutes did a great piece about this, I think in 2020 or so, 21, about there's things in the sky that we don't know what they are. And when I kind of just saw some of these, there's a great movie called, I can't remember the name of it, but 60 Minutes is a story about that. And I was like, wow, there's, you know, when you're seeing like senators from both sides of the aisle acknowledging there's things in the sky that we don't know what they are now, like much different being like, hey, is that an alien coming across versus, hey, what is, we just don't know what these things are. Those are very different. But when I saw that, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. And when I saw the kind of the diversity of the folks who were talking about it, you know, scientists, military, politicians from both sides of the aisle, it's like, wow, it made it a little more valid in my eyes that there's something to like worthy of exploration here for this. And kind of fast forward, and so Harvard had launched this study about using Professor Loeb had written this book called Oumuamua, this object that came through the solar system. And, you know, it said, hey, if it's based on his analysis, it's not, it doesn't have all these things that needs to be a comet. It doesn't have all those things. It doesn't have all these things. So if it's not X, Y, or Z, we have to assume maybe it's A or B. And A or B are things that might be from another intelligence that made it. Anyway, that was fascinating. He got a lot of blowback on that. And when I saw that he launched this study, what I thought to myself is, and this is right at the time of like George Floyd and all those difficult times that we were seeing in society and globally and, you know, kind of everything happening around just in the world. And I just thought, wow, there's one thing that is a handful of things that really unified people in society. It's space, it's education, it's science. And I just thought, what, regardless of how you feel about this topic, and I'm a skeptic myself, being a skeptic is healthy in life. You know, I think skeptic versus cynics are two different things. Being a skeptic is healthy. I was like, what a great way to inspire people about science. And what a great way to inspire kids about science and AI. And what a great way to kind of unify people about space. And I just remember, you know, when I was a kid, when the space shuttle would launch, you know, school would shut down that morning or afternoon that the space shuttle was launching, and you'd get into an auditorium or your classrooms would wheel in the TVs and we'd watch that. And it really, you know, that was the big thing going on in the world, was the space shuttle launching. It brought us all together. You know, you look at when we landed on the moon, you know, how much, you know, ticker tape parades celebrating these things. And even in the heart of the Cold War in the 70s, you know, we were doing joint, we had a joint mission with the Soviets in the 70s going up to the space station. And so space was always this area that unified us. And so what inspired me about Galileo was just this aspect of, I mean, an area that can really unify folks and inspire people, regardless if you're 80, 50, 30, 12, about science and AI. And I really thought about that. I mean, personally, like, I have some regrets in my own academics. And I remember I had a chance in high school. I forget, the Regents degree in New York State. You had certain curriculum you had to take. And I could have taken a fourth year of language or a fourth year of science. And I remember, because I would have had to take physics in high school, my senior year. And I didn't. I took a fourth year of a language, which was great. Like, languages are important, but I was intimidated to take that physics class. And I think I regret that in many ways, because physics is so interesting. And I think if I had really had an appreciation, you know, this is your course descriptions, is this is what we're going to learn, that really would have inspired me more about physics. And being around these scientists, and you just think that the creativity that is science is just fascinating. And so hence, that's why I got involved, because I think anything that's going to help inspire people around science and academics and AI, maybe bring us all a little bit closer, regardless of what you think about X, Y, or Z, you know, topic, is wonderful, I thought. So hence why I got involved.
Yeah, no, I love that you did. I, you know, if you think about, you know, some of the cohesive threads between space, education, science, AI, right? They all appeal to humanity's natural kind of gravitation to reach to what's next.
Yeah.
We are explorers, we're adventurers, we're innovators, right? So we're constantly looking for that next horizon.
Yeah.
And I really do, regardless of what our listeners think of UAP, and I know that a lot of our listeners are exploring. Mm-hmm. We can learn how observations, credible as observations in kind of the UAP
domain, yeah,
how those can inform our assumptions about physics, material science, right?
Yeah.
Basic science. There is much to learn. And I do think too that serious researchers, serious science, serious investors, right? Deep tech investors should all have an eye on really credible observations in the UAP domain and what that can and should mean for investments in new technologies, investments in new research. We, science and innovation and are basically our natural inclination to create, to your point, is informed by the fact that we don't know everything. We haven't created kind of the last innovations.
Yeah.
We need to constantly look at what we can learn from the phenomenon in nature around us to understand how we can reach further, how it can inform our assumptions and our development.
Absolutely.
I think it's a fascinating portfolio and really appreciate that the work that you and Avi are leading in that project and would encourage our listeners to follow your work there and to take a look at your incredible portfolio that you've invested in throughout your career, the Google work in education and AI, just really the expansive ecosystem that you have influenced throughout your career and in your current work is just amazing.
Thank you, Diane. I appreciate that. That's very, very nice of you to say. I wish I could take all credit for all those wonderful things, but I feel very fortunate that I've been able to be like kind of a player in it all and to see it firsthand. And I should give a lot of credit on the Galileo side. The work that's being done is, you know, Avi's work and the scientists that are involved with that. It's really astounding. I'm happy to kind of advocate for their work and give them a high five and a pat on the back because they're the ones that are doing the hard work. And it's also in many ways for a lot of scientists, this is a taboo topic, right? And so to have the bravery, I brought this into Google a couple times and I got some funny looks at me when I was, you know, and I can understand. And I was like, okay, maybe I'm not going to bring this up too much. I have bills I need to pay. So I have a lot of respect to folks like science, like there's real science going on. I think people like confuse the you know, kind of aluminum foil on their head versus the true valid science that's happening here. There's some like fascinating peer-reviewed papers on this stuff that is just mind-blowing, and it really shows you kind of the, I don't think, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners understand this, but a lot of like kind of just regular folks from other don't really understand the kind of the true scientific work, you know, peer-reviewed research being done now. It's fascinating and so interesting.
No, it truly will define the next several horizons in material science, physics, propulsion, right? So many domains that can be advanced just by, you know, a serious inquiry into what we can learn. So, David, I know we could talk for hours, clearly, but we're going to need to wrap it up there, unfortunately. But I'd love for you to leave just kind of a few closing thoughts for our listeners. And we'll share your contact information, the Galileo Project, et cetera, with our listeners. I know Missy will be following.
Yeah.
But for those that aren't, we'll make sure that they have that reference information as well.
Awesome. I guess my parting thoughts are, curiosity is one of the, like, I guess if you think curiosity is emotion, I don't know if that's the right way to describe it, but it's one of the healthiest emotions you could have in life, you know? And you think about what really, you know, brings you healthy happiness in life. It's learning new things and finding a community that shares your interest in certain areas and topics. And so what I think a lot of the folks who are listening to your podcast, these are folks that have a natural curiosity about some really interesting things and things that I don't think our society, you know, all the distractions our society has now, it's easy to lose sight of those things. I think in many ways, space was a lot more interesting in the 60s and the 80s than it is now because it was so novel at the time. You know, we have so many satellites up now. You don't really think about it. And I think that's unfortunate. And there's so many distractions. Anyway, net, one, I really appreciate the work that the folks at NASA, the folks who are probably listening to this podcast are doing, because I think it's incredible. Two, what I think is really exciting and awesome is, again, I have a lot of concerns about AI, but I'm also very excited about many things about AI. And the biggest thing is like how it democratizes learning and how what you have access to now to learn about right from your phone or your computer, and how that can make you successful in life professionally, academically, just is incredible. And so I would just, I guess I'm going to give some like words of advice. This is like kind of what these things about your parents that you thought were annoying when you're 12. Now you're like, wow, this is so helpful. This concept of always going back, always being a learner, and always like finding new things that interest you, and, you know, always taking advantage of that. And there's so many outlets now to learn, you know, everything from, I think the traditional university is such an opportunity now for folks to learn regardless of your age, to just what's available to you online is really awesome. And just to take advantage of that in a way that drives kind of healthy happiness.
Love that. Healthy happiness and lifelong learning really contributed to why we named our firm ShoshimWorks, Beginner's Mind, right?
And yeah, it's beautiful.
It's so critical. But David, thank you for the amazing kind of work that you have led. It's touched all of our lives, personally, professionally. Your fingerprints are all over kind of the human experience, and really appreciate your, you know, sharing a little bit of time and perspective with our listeners today, and look forward to keeping in touch.
And likewise.
Yeah, for our listeners out there, thank you as always for joining us. I hope you've enjoyed this as much as we have. And just if you have, please just keep in touch and follow the Ecosystemic Futures podcast series. Ecosystemic Futures is the ShoshimWorks Foresight series with NASA Heritage. And so thanks again, everyone. David, thank you.
Thank you, Diane. Take care.